Well, we've already kind of hinted at this a little bit, but just, you know, of course, the church was kind of in a season of corruption, and the Reformation happened, and then everything was perfect, right? Everything just went hunky-dory after that. Protestantism fixed everything, right? No, of course not. Of course not. And we had to be really careful as Protestants, and maybe especially as Baptists. You know, Baptists do. We have a reputation for sort of thinking we're the only ones that are right, you know, out in the world. And there are lots of reasons for that. And sometimes, you know, we sort of want to roll our eyes at every other tradition sometimes. You know what I mean? Just sort of like, well, I mean, if you guys only believed in the priesthood of every believer and had a bottom-up structure and everything else, everything would be fine. But we have to be really careful to remember that as Protestants and even as Baptists, we have to have a lot of humility when we look at others, because we're capable of bad things too. And there are plenty of bad things that happened even after the Reformation. So, but I do, let me just say this as we get started. It's important for us to remember that Jesus Christ is the hope for the world, not the Christian religion. Okay? Now, again, let me help you understand what I mean by that. What I mean is, by the Christian religion, what I mean is all the things that are said and done in the name of Christ, right? And presented as Christianity. As we recognize and note, not all of that's genuine biblical Christianity, is it? I mean, I don't think so, right? I mean, I've said and done things in my life that I would look back and I would tell someone, if they, you know, called me on it, I would say, you know what, that was not in line with the Bible. I'm wrong, okay? Go with the Bible. Go with Jesus on this. Jesus Christ and his gospel are the hope for the world. Now, I do believe in the Lord's church. I'm generally high on Christian institutions, generally speaking, still, no matter what. I mean, it's the reason I came to pastor a church like this instead of going to church plant or something like that, is I believe in what God's done already. Don't have a desire necessarily to reinvent the wheel. So we're trying to see an old institution grow and thrive. So don't mishear me. But at the same time, we have to remember, as Christians, we find ourselves kind of rocked by this. We are Jesus people. We're gospel people. And everything that's been done in the name of Jesus, Jesus would not own. He would not own. And there are a lot of things we see here that Jesus would not own. Early on, you can see then in Europe, post-Reformation, so in the 16th, 17th centuries is primarily where we're going to be, up into the maybe 18th century today, you can begin to see the way that the Reformation didn't really resolve any of the tensions that were present in Europe. We kind of talked about the milieu from which the Reformation came, some of the different things that are going on, populism and sort of an anti-establishmentarianism sort of developing in Europe, and then tensions in the church doctrinally. Just lots of different things are kind of the aftermath of the Renaissance. By the way, last week I had to do a correction. I've been accidentally mixing up terms on the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. So just so y'all know, if you've been confused wondering why in the world I was putting the Enlightenment in the 1400s, it's because I was switching out the terms on accident in my mind. So anyway, all that being said, we're still dealing with the aftermath of the Enlightenment. There's all sorts of fractures running through Europe, and the Reformation doesn't really make them better. In a lot of ways, it exacerbates some of those challenges, right? In some ways, makes them worse. So one of the things we see happening early on is in France, the French king massacres over 15,000, I mean over 10,000 Protestants on what's called the Bartholomew's Day Massacre. So this is a time when Protestants sort of became scapegoats in predominantly Catholic countries, like France was at the time. At this point, Protestantism is not legal in France. It's illegal to be Protestant, still predominantly Catholic. So if you've ever wondered why Catholicism is so prevalent in Francophile cultures, essentially it's because historically French culture has been Catholic. So if you've ever wondered why a city like Mobile or a city like New Orleans or even like St. Louis or Louisville, Kentucky, they're all named after Louis for a reason, okay? And they're all Francophile cities, and cities have been influenced by the French and founded by the French and French traders and everything else. And so I mean, the French tore the rivers up over here, all right? And they did a real good job of that. So those cities tend to have large Catholic populations because of the French histories there. So it's just something to remember. At this point, I think Jones argues that the king's wife kind of convinced him that the Huguenots, as French Protestants were known, the Huguenots were planning some sort of a revolt. And so, strike first and ask questions later is kind of the answer of the day, it seems like. And so, like I said, over 10,000 Protestants were massacred there on the Bartholomew's Day massacre. Let me just say also, during this time, and we'll talk about this just a little bit, there was also division, not only politically and not only in terms of some of the quote worldly divisions that we might consider, but there's also divisions within Protestant movements. And one of the most prominent, and one of the divisions, and then we get terms, and it's still impacting us to this day, is a division that happened among the followers of John Calvin during this time. So this is after Calvin has died, and a theologian begins to teach, a Calvinistic theologian, that is someone who followed Calvin. His name was Jacob Hermansoon, and he took the Latin name Arminius. And so he was from Holland. He was Dutch. And he studied under Beza, Theodore Beza, at Geneva, who was Calvin's successor. And so as he's kind of studying Calvinistic theology, and understand this, I want to make sure it's really clear. When I say Calvinistic theology, what I mean is the theology of the Reformed theology that came from Calvin after the Reformation. I don't mean what we would call Calvinism today. It's very narrowly focused because of this episode. I think Jones makes a pretty good argument for how this occurred. When we talk about Calvinism now, we're talking almost entirely about the doctrine of salvation. Soteriology. That's shorthand for that at this point. In these days, this is a more fully orbed theology that is non-Catholic Protestantism in Geneva and the surrounding areas. And so followers of John Calvin, so to speak. So that being the case, what you have happen is Arminius begins to teach a softer form of Calvinism, a softer Calvinism. Here's one thing Arminius taught. In his lapsed and sinful state, man is not capable of and by himself either to think or to will or to do that which is really good. But it is necessary for him to be regenerated and renewed in his intellect, affections, or will, and in all his powers, by God in Christ through the Holy Spirit, that he may be qualified rightly to understand, esteem, consider, will, and perform whatever is truly good. Now, over the years, what's basically happened is anything that's not Calvinism gets called Arminianism, and anything that's not Arminianism gets called Calvinism when it comes to views of God's sovereignty. And so it's important for us, like people say, oh, that guy's Arminian. They really know what they even mean by that exactly. So essentially, Arminius made sort of 5 points, Arminius's followers put forth 4-5 points that they said kind of encapsulated what Arminius taught, and they became known as the Remonstrance. The Remonstrance. So these are people who are following Arminius's teachings, and they put forth a Remonstrance. So, and essentially, it's like I said, a softer articulation of Calvinism. And it's Arminianism is something that many Baptists throughout the years, a more Arminian understanding of God's sovereignty and salvation is something many Baptists have held to over the years. But I will also say a more Dorsian, which we'll talk about in just a moment, more robust Calvinism is also something many Baptists have held to over the years. So people will say, well, which one of those do Baptists believe? And I'll say, show me the Baptists and I'll tell you. You know, there's been a long history, and we'll get into that soon. As Baptists came out of the Reformation, there have been streams of Baptists who have been all across the board on these issues. So the Remonstrance basically puts forth five points. And so then the more strict, maybe I should say a stricter Calvinism. It's like, sometimes like people say a strict Calvinism. I say, is there any other kind? Anyway, but I like to get a little jab in on my Calvinist buddies when I can. But anyway, the Arminians they become known as Remonstrants. And then so the more strict Calvinists respond to them at a meeting. They come together at what's called a synod or a meeting. And it comes known as the Synod of Dort. The Synod of Dort. And so what emerges out of there is a five-point rebuttal to the Remonstrants. And this becomes known as what we would call Dortian Calvinism, D-O-R-T-I-A-N. So the 5 points of Calvinism that emerge from Dort. Now, let me just say, I think Jones makes this point well. The Institutes of Christian Religion deal very little with the doctrine of salvation, with soteriology. So the reason these 5 points have come to define Calvinism this way is just simply because it emerged from a debate that happened in church history that I think got a little out of hand, frankly, you know, and it still is a little. But so because this is what everybody chose to throw down about. And I'm not saying these points don't matter, but what I mean is because this is kind of what everyone decided to throw down about, it has come to define, it has had an outsized, it has defined Calvinism in an outsized way since. And frankly, I think in a way that makes our learning of the Reformers difficult and challenging, and in a way that adds typically more heat than light to our theological discussions about a beautiful doctrine, God's sovereignty, right? Something that should bring us peace and joy and hope, and Christians tend to fight about it. And it's kind of a, sometimes I think like, man, let's not fight about that. Let's rejoice and celebrate in it and own our differences. And I understand that some people just want to fight about it. And we don't always choose what we have to fight about, do we? Sometimes people choose it for us. And so we recognize that. So this stricter Calvinism emerges out of this. The 5 points responding to the Remonstrants are now what we would call the 5 points of Calvinism. These are kind of emerged, the summary of these things. So the 5 points of Calvinism are summarized by a acronym, TULIP, T-U-L-I-P, TULIP. So I'll tell you what these each stand for, just so you know, and you can kind of have an idea of what the Synod of Dort presented. And these are all rebuttals to similar points in the Remonstrance from Arminius. So T is for total depravity. Total depravity. U is for unconditional election. L is for limited atonement. I is for what's come to be known as irresistible grace. And then P is for perseverance of the saints. Perseverance of the saints. So let me just say, for most Baptists, believe a mixture of the five, about soteriology in particular, most Baptists are somewhere, they're some mixture of Arminius's 5 points and the rebuttal 5 points, the Dortian 5 points. So for example, Arminius thought you could potentially lose your salvation. He wasn't 100% sure on that. So we would hold to, for example, perseverance of the saints, right? I mean, that's a hallmark of Baptist theology, that you can do that. So that's something, that's a heritage theologically that we owe to our more Calvinistic brothers and sisters in the faith. Total depravity, we're gonna typically define more like the Dortians than we are like Arminius. But many of us are going to, especially, for example, limited atonement, we're going to tend to, define it almost identically to Arminius, the understanding of the atonement, which is that Jesus died for everyone, that his blood is sufficient for for everyone, but it's only efficient for those who put their trust and faith in Jesus. It's only effective for those who put faith and trust in Jesus. Whereas our Reformed friends are going to argue that Jesus died definitively only for the elect. And that's not to say that they don't believe anyone can be saved. They put faith and trust in Jesus. They just believe only the elect are going to do that. And that Jesus only suffered. He didn't suffer needlessly. Logically, it makes a lot of sense. It's not something I hold to biblically, though. But I think some people say, well, that must be heresy, or they must hate the lost if they believe that. No, nothing can be further from the truth. And if you read the Bible, if you sit down and read the Bible with a Calvinist, you can see they have a really strong biblical argument for what they believe. They love the Lord Jesus Christ, and love the Bible. And I mean, I've said this a bunch of times. I've been mentored and taught and spent a lot of good, joyful time with a lot of dear 5-point Calvinist friends, and I wouldn't trade them for the world. You know, I wouldn't trade them for the world. And I've also been discipled and mentored and loved and led in the Lord by some brothers and sisters who are more way more Armenian than me. You know, they're going to be almost all in on. I mean, they're just way more. They have a way lower view of God's sovereignty than I do, and I wouldn't trade them for the world. Right? I'm thankful for them. And so what it's important, I think, that we do is we study the Bible, is what does the Scripture say, and that we believe it according to our conscience, and we live it out, and that we all just hunker down on just in between a couple of goalposts, all right? Here's one. Salvation belongs to the Lord, right? If we get to a place, I think where we start to get into grave error is when we start to say things like, when we get out of a more Arminian understanding of salvation and we get into what we would know as a Pelagian or semi-Pelagian understanding of salvation, which starts to think that man can do something to save himself, right? That's anathema, okay? We cannot do anything to save it. We do not contribute to our salvation. We cannot save ourselves. We do not do that. We cannot do that. So that's one goalpost I think we need to really hang tight on, okay? But then on the other side, there's another goalpost that when we get in over into something like hyper-Calvinism, which is where we become fatalists, right? And we stop believing in things like the free offer of the gospel, offering the gospel freely to anyone and everyone at any time, you know, that we preach in such a way that we only offer the gospel to the elect. And that's not really what actual Calvinists believe. That's what hyper-Calvinists believe, and that they're very rare to find. You know why? They don't lead anybody to Jesus, right? They only emerge from people that are already Christians. You know, there's not these great hyper-Calvinist evangelism movements. But there are huge. In fact, the modern missions movement was started by a guy named William Carey, who was a Calvinist. Okay? And so some of the most famous missionaries in our history were Calvinists. So they are not anti-missions at all. Some of the most robust, passionate evangelists I know are Calvinists. And so we want to stay between those goalposts and walk in love and learn the lesson of the sort of irascibility that some of these folks had. I mean, we saw it already with Luther and Zwingli. Well, you look back at that and just say, I think Bob and I were talking about this last week. He said, man, it just feels like if they could have just gotten together on the Lord's Supper, it would have been better. You know what I mean? To have the Zwinglians and the Lutherans together, it seems like it would have been a good thing, and yet they just couldn't do it. And in the same way here, you know, you kind of wish that these folks had handled this a little bit differently, and there had been a lot more light and a lot less heat really throughout church history. So all being said, that's essentially the 5 points of Calvinism and kind of how they emerged as such historically. And again, I just do want to reiterate, those are not things that John Calvin, you're never going to go find anywhere in John Calvin's writings. These are the 5 points of Calvinism. In fact, I would probably assume that Calvin would be very uncomfortable with the term Calvinists. I think he would want people to follow Jesus and say that they follow Jesus. Any questions about that so far? I know that can be a real hot button issue, and I know lots of folks over history and throughout their lives have had challenges along those lines sometimes. So anytime it comes up, I want to make sure I'm trying to provide as much more light than heat on these things. But does anybody have any questions about that to make that clearer? I will say I think Jones's account is pretty good. I think it's helpful. I guess one question we might have during this time, and we kind of skipped over this part of the chapter last week, but I wanted to just mention it really quickly tonight, is what's going on in Catholicism during this time? During this time, 1538, the Catholic Church responds to the Reformation. And it's what's called the Council of Trent. So you might have heard of Tridentine Catholicism. The Council of Trent deeply shaped Catholicism for the 400 years after it happened. So they come together and they make some good changes, right? Some things we wish they would do. And then they double down on some other stuff. Okay, and a lot of what we understand as Roman Catholicism was really codified and solidified at Trent. So, for example, they doubled down on the inability of priests to marry. They doubled down on a few other kind of distinctly Roman Catholic things. They kind of circled the wagons on those. But, in a good way, they abandoned or quit pushing the sale of indulgences and worked on corruption and worked on some things like that as well. So you have that big move during that time. Also during this time, you have what's called the Jesuit movement. That is one of the largest missionary movements in human history. And the Jesuits kind of travel the world doing that. And then at times, as we're going to see, and I think some of what y'all were talking about earlier, they do Catholic missionaries over time become agents of colonialism in ways that are less than ideal for Christianity. So we'll want to keep an eye on that. Another group, and maybe I'm taking a point of personal privilege, this might not be the most important aspect of church history, but I've already mentioned this. There was a group during this time called the Jansenists that emerged that started taking a similar path to the Reformers, but they stayed on the Catholic side of the fence. And they really were a recovery movement really rooted in Augustinian theology, which I think you've heard me say this, basically with Luther and Calvin and others, Augustine was hugely formative in their understanding of salvation. Same thing sort of happens with the Jansenists. And one of the most interesting figures that emerges on the fringes of the Jansenist movement, his family became Jansenist. He never quite becomes a Jansenist, but has a lot of proclivities in that direction, is a brilliant thinker named Blaise Pascal. Now, some of you might be thinking, that name sounds familiar to me. Where have I heard the name Pascal before? I don't think it's in Christianity. Well, Pascal is probably one of the most brilliant men in human history. In fact, I just was over at Emma Sansom at the middle school with Watsy, as well. I was late for supper tonight. She had a little Scholars Bowl scrimmage over there. And one of the questions was about Pascal, but it had nothing to do with religion. And the metric measurement, I think they said, for pressure is named after Pascal. Because he had he determined a theory or a I'm showing you guys how ignorant we'll get back to his theology soon where I can talk, but anyway, on the science side of things, I'm not so great, but he basically made some of the scientific advances and some of the scientific discoveries that led to be able to understand pressure the way it needs to be understood, and there are other countless ways that he made contributions to mathematics and science as well. And yet I would say, if he had finished his book on apologetics, okay, I think we would probably almost universally say he was the most brilliant apologist in Christian history. I would say he is the forerunner for what we would call like modern cultural apologetics. His work is now known as the work he was working on. So he was working on a defense of Christianity for skeptics. In a time period when science was beginning to rise, we're after the Renaissance, but we're on the brink of the Enlightenment in Pascal's day, right? And he's a brilliant scientist and natural thinker. And so he has friends during this era who are abandoning the faith and having a hard time. So what does Pascal do? He begins to write a defense of Christianity. And so what he does, he takes these little strips of paper and he'll write out a little saying on it, and he has a number on it, and he files it, and we find hundreds. They found, after he dies, hundreds of these sayings, some bigger, some smaller, some whole paragraphs, some whole pages, with numbers on them. And so what we've had to do is take all these words that he wrote down and recreate them to try to figure out what kind of argument he was making. And so if you recreate them, if you put it together and kind of read between the lines a little bit, you can see he was making a masterful, masterful argument for the veracity and truthfulness of Christianity, and for the warrant of belief. This work is now known as the Penses, P-E-N-S-E-E-S, which just means sayings in French. And so people read it as just this little collection of Proverbs, but there are a couple of works that help reconstruct what he's trying to do. The best of which, my opinion, is a book called Christianity for Modern Pagans by Peter Kreeft, and it is awesome. So right in the middle of this book was one of the most famous arguments in Christian history called Paschal's Wager. You guys heard about this? Paschal's Wager? I used to hate it. I just used to think it was the worst thing I'd ever heard, Pascal's Wager. So here's the wager. Pascal, in this section of the Pensées, basically says to an imaginary interlocutor, he says, right, but if you're right, and there is no God, and I believe, what have I really lost? Right? Okay. He says, but if I'm right, you know, and I believe, and I'm right, and you're wrong, what have you lost? You've lost infinite everything, right? So, first of all, let me tell you why I hated it. Can you guess why I hated it? Well, I don't think you can twist people's arm into Christianity, right? I used to think, like, man, that's just a cop-out. Like, all you're doing is just twisting their arm. Until I read Kreeft and had a professor who helped us understand what Pascal was really doing, and until I understood his Augustinian proclivities. What does Augustine say? Augustine says we are incapable of following God without God's help, right? Sin has so impacted us that without God's help, we can't follow God. And so what Pascal was trying to do, this was not his only argument. This is in the middle of the Pensées. And what he was saying is this, because he goes on to argue and says this. He says, so if the only reason you didn't believe was pure reason, if it was only pure reason that kept you from believing, you would never take this wager. Pure reason would incline you to believe, right? So what does Pascal say? He says, so if it can't just be pure reason that's keeping you from believing, it has to be something else. And he says, it's your passions that are at work within you. So he knows it, this is not the end of the book. It's not the beginning of the book. This is a tool by which Pascal is trying to shake people out of the fact that they are not as purely reasonable as they think they are. And in that sense, it's one of the most brilliant arguments for Christianity, I think, ever. And it's essentially the backbone of how I think about defending and presenting the faith to people. I don't necessarily use the wager exactly, but I do am passionate about and am very drawn to arguments that help people see that they're not as reasonable as they think they are, which is basically my job in a nutshell. No, I'm just kidding. But you know, trying to help people say, you know, you're not being as reasonable as you think you're being. You're not pure reason. Something else must be going on, or you might be thinking differently here, and helping people see that sin's more impactful than they think it is. So that's some of the movements in Catholicism during this time. And I just like to give a good shout out to my boy Pascal every time I get a chance. There is a lot going on during this time in terms of political upheaval as well. And one of my favorite titles for a historical event happens during this season. This is called the Defenestration of Prague. The Defenestration of Prague. Does anybody know what it means to defenestrate? It means to throw out a window. All right. And so some Catholic envoys come to Protestant Prague and to Prague, and Protestants come to them and say from the Holy Roman Empire, and the Protestants come with complaints and they won't hear. And so do you know what the Protestants do? They throw them out the window, and if it doesn't kill them, they land in a pile of manure. So it's just not a good day to be a Catholic official. You know what I mean? It's just not a good day. But it begins what comes to be known as the 30 Years' War, which is a vicious war during this season as well. Also, during this time, particularly in England, we didn't quite get to it, but in your reading, you cover the fact that that the Church of England at this point has also separated from the Roman Church, not because of purely theological reasons, but primarily for practical reasons for Henry, because the Pope wouldn't grant him an annulment. And so now the Church of England emerges. And so the Church of England is dealing with its own set of circumstances because the ideas of Protestantism have crossed the channel from Europe. The continent is invading. The ideas of the continent are coming over into England. And then on top of that, you don't have that central authority of the Pope anymore. You just have the Church of England. And so you're having some challenges there too. During this time, you have a movement among the Church of England that comes to be known as Puritanism, which is one of, I would argue, the most misunderstood movements in our world. The Puritans were broad theologically. Most of them were Reformed. Some stayed in the Church of England, but most of them had some sort of general Reformation proclivities. Some were more Calvinistic, some were less Calvinistic, but all of them, by and large, some were even Baptists, as we'll see. But they all had a desire to see the Church of the Lord Jesus Christ purified, and they wanted to have a true, genuine experience of God by His Word and His Spirit. And so, in fact, we have a word now, puritanical, you know, that we use about things, just people that are sour and dour and have no fun and this kind of thing. Well, the Puritans were actually the opposite of those things. I think you'll notice that they're one of the ways that secular people tend to discount Christianity is in those sorts of ways, like sort of like the Dark Ages, as we've talked about, calling the Middle Ages the Dark Ages, and then calling Puritans something they really weren't. Now, they were strict in different ways, but the world was stricter in different ways during this time as well. So one famous Puritan, I mean, we can't get to them all. I like a lot of them. If you're interested in Puritan thinking, and just getting a good dose of the Puritans without necessarily reading the Puritans, because it can be a challenge to read the Puritans, I might suggest a book. We've read it together during COVID, but you might not have all read it. A book called Gentle and Lowly by Dane Ortlund, which leans heavily on a lot of Protestant thinking, Puritan thinking, and quotes a lot of Puritans, and is just a marvelous book. If you want to get a dose of what it means to, a reminder of what it means to be loved by Jesus, I might encourage you to read Gentle and Lowly. I needed it more than I thought I did. I read it, and it was like a oasis in the desert for me in the middle of COVID. And we read it as a church. Did any of you guys read that with me? Read Gentle and Lowly with me? But you get a lot of quotes of Puritans and get exposure to a broad range of Puritan thought. During this time, you do have a thinker named John Owen, who makes a big theological contribution to Dorsian Calvinism, really strongly advocates for limited atonement in a book called The Death of Death and the Death of Christ. Let me just read to you from Owen really quickly. To those who state God bestows faith on some, not on others, I reply, did Jesus Christ purchase this distinguishing grace for those who receive it in a manner not true of those who do not receive it? If that is so, then Christ did not die equally for all, for he died that some might have faith, but not others. Indeed, in comparison, he cannot be said to die at all for those others. For he did not die in order that they might have faith. And he knew that all the rest of his work would be unprofitable and fruitless without faith. But suppose, on the other hand, that saving faith is not purchased for the elect by Christ. Then have those that are saved no more for which to thank Christ than those that are damned? Which is strange and contrary to Revelation 1, chapter 5 and 6. Unto him that loved us and washed us from our sins in his own blood. I would say that Owen's book, The Death of Death and the Death of Christ, is probably one of the most powerful, I shouldn't say powerful because I've not read it. It's one of the most influential books in terms of helping convince people who become Calvinists, five-point Calvinists in their thinking, to become Calvinistic in their thinking. So that's John Owen. And you can see, I read that because I want you to hear, this is somebody from the 1600s who clearly loves the Lord and has a good, strong argument that thinks differently than some of us do, and that's okay. Baxter and others were also Puritans in this sense, and then also many of the Puritans began to experience religious persecution during this time, and so that's when what we now know as pilgrims begin to develop. And so kind of pilgrims went in two different directions, and both sort of changed the world. And both impacted us greatly, and Jones talks about this. One group of pilgrims, sort of oppressed Puritans, came to America, right? And began colonies and helped, quote, found the New World. And then the other group went to Holland to flee religious persecution, and they began what really essentially became the British Baptist movement, which is really where Southern Baptists, American Baptists are most closely identified with. We have a lot of dear friends and brothers who associate us a little bit more with the Anabaptist movement, for whom I'm very thankful, but historically it's a little bit harder to draw a line from the Anabaptist to the Southern Baptist Convention than it is to draw a line from the British Baptists to the Southern Baptist Convention. So we're a little more tied to the British Baptist movement. In fact, now's a good time to talk about Baptists. This group, Anabaptists, develops during the Reformation. That means to be baptized again, so it's kind of a derogatory term. And out of that group, we talked a little bit about Menno Simons and others last week, the Mennonites and other groups like that sort of developed out of the Anabaptist movement. But some of those sort of devolved into a kind of radicalism that we wouldn't so much associate with. At the same time, the group that went over to the group of pilgrims, so to speak, that went over to Amsterdam, went over to Holland. One was named Smith, and the other was named Helwys. And they began what comes to be known as the General Baptist movement in Great Britain. So when they finally come back and start churches, they are at this point fully immersionist, basically. And then simultaneously, or kind of around the same time, you have a group. They become known as the General Baptists. They're going to be a little more Arminian, a little more influenced by the Anabaptists over on the continent. Then this other group that emerges beginning in the late 1630s, early 1640s, called the English Particular Baptists. And these are going to be folks that tend to dissent from the Church of England over the issue of baptism and develop churches in Great Britain in the early 1600s. And this is the group that's most closely associated with the group that eventually becomes the Southern Baptists, our Baptists here in the United States. So by 1640, this group exclusively holds to baptism by immersion. They are more reformed theologically. They're going to be more Calvinistic theologically. And they also emerge from the Puritan movement. So basically what's happening in these reform movements of the churches, this group will go this far on an issue, purifying the church, on holiness, on everything else. The next group will go this far on an issue. And then finally, you have groups that also have finally kind of come to a conclusion on the issue of baptism that requires them really to leave the established church, Church of England, and start independent churches. This is all of these churches that leave the Church of England are known as dissenters in Britain. So this is the dissenting church in Great Britain during this time, many of which are Puritans. But during this time, I think it's important to remember that many Puritans stayed inside the Church of England, and then others do become dissenters. So when we start thinking about religious history in Great Britain, it can be confusing sometimes because some people are Puritans, and there are Puritans who are Anglican, there are Puritans who are Baptist, there are Puritans who are Congregationalist, there are Puritans who are this group, Puritans who are that group, and so there's a mixed bag there, and we can sometimes get confused on that. So it's something that's important for us to remember. Examples of particular Baptists would be John Bunyan, who wrote Pilgrim's Progress. I don't know how many of you guys read Pilgrim's Progress with me, but if you've never read Pilgrim's Progress, read Pilgrim's Progress. It's wonderful. Who read any Pilgrim's Progress testimonies in the house? Anybody read it? Yeah. What'd you guys think about it? It was awesome. Thanks, y'all. I agree. I think it's fantastic. Yeah, I love Pilgrim's Progress. If you've never read Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, it's wonderful. He wrote it while he was in jail for being a dissenting pastor. And Bunyan was a Baptist. Let me read to you a little bit from Pilgrim's Progress. Let me see. Christian ran thus till he came at a place somewhat ascending, and upon that place stood a cross and a little below in the bottom a sepulchre. So I saw in my dream that just as Christian came up with the cross, his burden loosed from off his shoulders and fell from off his back and began to tumble, and so continued to do till it came to the mouth of the sepulchre, where it fell in, and I saw it no more. That's the time when the pilgrim Christian becomes a Christian. It's real beautiful. Beautiful story. So during this time as well, you have an early Baptist statement of faith that develops. It's called the 1689 Second London Confession, which is a Reformed Baptist confession of faith that over time has had a lot of influence on all Baptist confessions of faith, or most Baptist confessions of faith, including our own. And if you were to go read the 1689 Second London Confession, you can see the way it's influenced later the Baptist Faith and Message 2000. It's been softened a little and changed in some ways, but still it's a very influential statement of faith, a confession of faith. And so it's important to also recognize, as Baptists argue some of the things we argue right now about creeds and confessions and everything like that, the earliest Baptists are writing confessions and holding to confessions. I mean, that's as early as 1689 that you have the second London Confession of Faith. But with all the good things that are happening and all the bad things that are happening, it's not without the way the world's being reshaped. During this season, this time, you begin to have colonialism that will radically reshape the world and in so many ways shapes the modern world that we live in. I think that the desire for empire, by and large, was a misguided, what's the word for it? I think the desire to control the world the way many nations in Europe try to control the world during this season bore some good fruit, like this. You know, I love America. I'm glad it's where I live. I'm thankful for it. But also, as we've seen, a lot of bad fruit as well, right? And some of which we're still reaping bad consequences from. The meddling in other people's affairs that happened there, and the desire, the greed and the avarice that was represented in some of the way that people were trying to essentially steal resources from native peoples and others. So we want to own that, the reality of colonialism. Also, this time of colonialism reshapes the world in the spread of disease, in the spread of foodstuffs. Tomatoes, okay, think about this. Tomatoes don't come from Italy, right? It's not until after colonialism that Italy gets tomatoes, right? Potatoes were only in South America. So you just think about just the way crops travel at this point. So you just think about, there's no such thing as an Arsh potato before colonialism, right? There's no such thing. There are no potatoes in Ireland. There's a Peruvian potato, and it's about this big and filled with seeds. It's not delicious, you know? And so we have greatly modified food over time to make it delicious to eat and everything else. And so that's one thing to remember. So that's just one way the world changed through the impact of colonialism. So germs and seeds and weapons and all sorts of soldiers are going all over the world and radically reshaping the world at this point. And then you also have, I think we would all think, one of the greatest blights in human civilization, the transatlantic slave trade, develops during this time. You know, the Bible talks about slavery, but it's a radically different system than the race-based chattel slavery that was present in the transatlantic slave trade. And it's something we have to recognize and reckon with, and reckon with the absolute, not only compliance that Christians had with the slave trade, but the absolute celebration and propagation that Christians had with the slave trade. But then we also recognize, I mean, this is one of the things, like, you have a lot of people right now trying to argue that Christianity is inherently flawed because of the role that a lot of Christians had in the slave trade. And in particular, you have a lot of those arguments being made in the United States because of the history of slavery here. And not only the history of slavery, but even after slavery, the history of baked-in racism during the Jim Crow era and other things like that that are deeply problematic. And so Christianity kind of gets lumped in with that. And sometimes I can't blame folks. If I read the history and it's all I knew of Christianity was what I'd read in some of the history books, I'd be kind of worried about it myself. But the reality is, if you just say, well, any sort of evangelical theology must be tainted because it was so widely held by slaveholders, at the same time, it was also widely held by emancipationists in Great Britain. Newton and others. Spurgeon preached strongly against slavery. Spurgeon could have become a very rich man selling sermons. He made a literal fortune through selling copies of his sermons, the penny pulpit. And they sold most briskly in the southeast of the United States. I mean, they just ate him up over here. And so Spurgeon did not become wealthy, though. He used that money to fund this unbelievable ministry enterprise that he developed in London and elsewhere. He had orphanages. And if you've taken my Spurgeon class, you know, I mean, it's just unbelievable what it took. And he died not destitute or anything like that, but he certainly didn't die rich because he gave so much money away and used all that money to do that. So It was at a real crucial time when one of his key ministries needed funding, and the penny pulpit was funding it, that Spurgeon preached a sermon that basically said he would not take the Lord's Supper. He would have no fellowship with a slaveholder. Well, needless to say, his sermon stopped selling so well in the South in the 1800s. Just didn't go so well for Spurgeon, to the point that I've read newspaper articles in Montgomery, Alabama, in the 1800s after that sermon was released, where people came together, people from all over Montgomery came out in the town, and they burned all their copies of Spurgeon's sermons. In fact, at one point, he was burned in effigy in a town in the South, all right, for his stand on slavery. Now, that's not just a sin, that's an idol, right, guys? I mean, it was baked into these desires. So during this time, you see slavery emerging, and colonialism, the way the world changes through colonialism, through disease, and through slavery, greatly impacts Christian history from this point up until right now. Up until right now. So as we get ready to read the rest of the history, we have to keep those things in our mind and see the way the world's impacted by those things. So all being said, thank you all so much. And as you can see, Christian history is not perfect, but thankfully we serve a perfect Christ. And for that, we're thankful. Thank you all for being here. I appreciate you.